that this feeling warm-hearted words you gave to me and to the scene we are talking and to the children you rose in our training seminars. And you invited me and asked me if I can say something about the trainings at the beginning, before we start. Some few words, I'd like to give some few words on the training. This training is maybe particular and rare in North America, because existential analysis and logotherapy are based on the person, and the main tool in the work with clients and patients is the personality of the therapist itself, himself, herself. So the training is focusing mainly the development of the personality and the access of the psychotherapist to himself, to herself, so that he or she can be present essentially and work with understanding and encountering and dialoguing. It's pretty close to Carl Rogers' approach, but it's a bit more existential. Existentialist, this means it is more a bit more confronting, and it's a bit more philosophical maybe from its origins. And we try to apply this attitude, this phenomenological existential attitude, into the practice to give space to the person of the client, to the intimate, deep personality, and to what a person makes it, or what a person is, what a person moves. And the speciality is that maybe you are used to, in North America, CBT is the number one, of course, and this approach is, CBT is much more methodological, technical, manualized in its approach. We have manuals, but we use mainly something else. We use the therapist in existential analysis is there, and the specific is that he knows nothing, and he comes and tries to understand what is going on, what is moving the client out from what the client and patient is telling by himself or herself, out of how he is saying and speaking up and looking like, and how the voice is, and how he or she is what he or she is selecting to talk about, and trying to understand, and then giving back, reflecting what is understood and what is not understood, and so together we develop and we develop the thread and what is essential for the client and the patient. So in difference to most psychotherapies, a phenomenological approach claims from the therapist that he knows nothing and is very open to what appears, what comes up, and the task is mainly to understand, and by taking a position and by reflecting what is understood on the background, the whole bunch of theory, 4 years of training, you know, many, many seminars, a lot of psychology, philosophy, anthropology, methods, out, but from this background, we distance ourselves and open ourselves again, because this case is new and has never been described. This situation has never been treated in a psychotherapy. And so with this view of singularity and uniqueness of the person, this is what we mainly work with. And this needs, of course, quite a bit of training for the personality of the therapist, that he or she is open enough, can open herself, himself, to the new which is coming up in the dialogue. And I do this work since many years and some decades already, and it's still interesting for me to do it, because it's there are repetitions, of course, of all what is pathologic, and pathologic is determined reactive behavior, of course. I know this well enough, and I often think that I could describe the anxiety, the phobia, even more correctly than the patient can do it, because I heard it 100 times, and so. But it is very interesting, again, to listen to a client, how he or she describes it, what is the specific cultural background, the individual background, the person in that, struggling with that repression or prison of psychopathology, and coming to an encounter on that basis is so intriguing and fascinating again and again. And meeting a person is always a gift. And so this happens even after more than 30 years of work in psychotherapy. And this is really something I love. And I want to continue to do that. And I do not think about pension, because I almost am addicted to that work, which leads me to this thing. Well, I have prepared some chapters for this evening. We start with meaning, describe addiction, look at the human, look to addiction as a human inclination. We look at the development of addiction, some words about prevention, and a bit more about therapy. Meaning has a power. Meaning means that when we know what we are living for, what we are doing that, what we are suffering, for what we are suffering, what we have to undergo to suffer. This gives us a strength, a spiritual strength, a personal power, which enables us to overcome so many difficult situations. Viktor Frankl, who was the one who did the most work in the field of meaning in psychotherapy and psychology, himself experienced the power of meaning when he overcame 2.5 years of concentration camps. Although he was in despair sometimes, but what did help him to overcome and not to feel that his neck is broken by the situation was this striving, or this orientation towards a greater value which is overcoming the situation. Values which are sometimes very small values, like experience something good, a sunset, a flower, even concentration camp, an eye catch, or an eye, the eye view of a body, a side of him, or to do something valuable, like giving a word, giving some verbal support or practical support to this body, or to create something, to do the daily work, if we can experience it as a value. And a third main road to meaning is to come to an attitude which allows us to support pain, suffering, fate, fatal or terminal illness, etc. We can do it with human dignity, and to work on this and to elaborate this attitude of facing a value, the value of life itself. This is also very powerful, and was a center in Viktor Frankl's logotherapy. Logos means meaning, therapy through meaning in logotherapy, which he described very, very accurately. The clinical effect of meaning is that it was in an investigation, I take just one investigation in 1996 by Debats in Holland. He investigated patients in an outpatient clinic, and found out that meaning helps to reduce, when people have meaning, a high score in the life regard index, then they had less stress, they felt happier, they had more self-esteem, a better well-being, and did better progress in psychotherapy. So we can see also statistically and empirically that the meaning, the lived meaning, the experienced meaning helps to endure, to overcome, to mobilize potential which is helpful to confront difficult life situations and to also to confront losses and to help to overcome grief processes, etc. Experiencing meaning needs a special activity. To come to meaning, we need to come to an inner consent. An inner consent means a yes to something. Meaning, to describe meaning once more before we come to, we deepen this issue. What is meaning? Meaning is the purpose and meaning, we should say. We possibly use both terms. Purpose and meanings means that we are directed to something which we experience as being good, worthy, helpful, creative. As long as we have a feeling and then possibly the knowledge, but basically it's really the feeling that what I'm doing or what I'm experiencing is leading to something good or is good in itself, it is it is interesting. As long as we have such a feeling, such a connection, such a relationship to something valuable, to talk with the child about their homework and to feel the love to that child and to feel that I do something good to help him or her, and the child is not only suffering or I do not exert pressure on the child, then it's not meaningful. It is more a desperate action. But as long as I feel the value when I do that, then this is meaningful. Meaningful is being directed towards a value, towards something which is good in my eyes, in my opinion, in my heart, in my feelings. So when we are confronted with some valuable issue, good music, good dinner, good work, interesting book, nice encounter and talk and so. And as long as we have something valuable in front of us, we are invited to take a personal stand towards it. And the personal stand is to take up the inner resonance we have, the inner resonance of what is it saying within me? Is it saying yes or no? And if I feel a yes to what I do, then I have inner consent. This is not rational, this is emotional. Consent means sentiment. With my sentiment in it, then it is a consent to what I do. Inner harmony. I feel correspondence. I feel that it corresponds to me. We are familiar. And so I can dedicate myself, commit myself, give myself into what I do. This happens on a constant inner and outer, on the basis of a constant inner and outer dialogue. The inner dialogue with myself, I'm asking myself, how is that for me? How does it resonate within me? If it is a positive resonance, then I shall continue, I should continue, and I should do only things to what I have an inner consent. And outer dialogue, I have to reconnect again with the values and to work on them, to perceive them more and better, to come closer to them, to detect what is behind. And so we can interact with the world and come to a fulfilling life and to a meaningful life. Frankl said, as a basis before we come to that consent, we need even something more. We need a phenomenological attitude. Phenomenological means, simply translated, an open attitude. This is this openness about which I spoke before when I spoke about the typical existential psychotherapy procedure. We are open, and openness means nothing, having nothing in mind, no prejudice, no idea, no theory which would explain the symptomatology. We do not explain, we try to understand. Explain means reduction to a theory. Explaining means seeing what is unique in you, what is moving you. And so the same phenomenological attitude is applied, or is the main key to find meaningful elements in our life. The phenomenological attitude of openness, openness towards the world, openness towards the inside, double openness. And Frankl put it into this sentence. He's by saying, we have to understand ourselves as being questioned by life, continuously asked by the situation. Whatever is there is a question for us. How do we deal with it? What are we going to do with it? We are invited by life to give our answers to the questions of the situation, to the life questions. And every moment is a life question. This is a life question. Can you make use of what we are talking about? How can you make use of it? Where? For yourself, for your clients, for your work, for your children. So we continue by saying, behind each must, having in mind inner consent, behind each must there is an unconscious will or a conscious will. What am I saying with that? Freedom is essential for the human being. We are, in our essence, we are free. We are so free that we cannot stop being free. And so we cannot avoid and step out of freedom. This means we can take that radically. There is no force. Nothing can force ourselves in our life. There is only one force. We are forced to live until we die, and we are forced to die. But not, if we feel to be forced to something, then we are forced only because we want to live as an ultimate horizon in which happens coercion. When we feel menaced, we feel forced. When there is anxiety, we feel forced. When we are addicted, we feel forced. And our understanding, our coming out from the existential philosophy and the background and the existential analytical anthropology concept of man, this understanding makes it obvious and clear that I'm never forced ultimately. I'm forced only because I want something, because there is a will. And ultimately it is the will to live. And so I'm forced to eat, to drink, to sleep. I'm forced because I want to live. I'm forced to deal with problems and conflicts because I want to live, etc. So we will come back to this notion later on when we speak about addiction. Addiction is a coercion. But behind this coercion, there is something greater, which has to do with freedom. And it will be the art in the therapy of addiction to bring out what is the freedom behind in addiction, and how we can make use of the freedom in the treatment of addiction. since we are speaking about addiction, we have to make a notion about will, an additional notion. Will is the resolution to get involved in a chosen value. Resolution means after having decided what is between the possibilities I have, what is the best possibilities, I finally get my, I come to my yes to the best possibility, or to maybe not the best, it is still freedom, it is still my will, to say, but will is a yes to something valuable, to something valuable is good. To come here, you have got the information about this presentation, and this presentation promised something valuable for you. For many reasons it can be valuable, but something which sounds interesting, which sounds helpful, which may be inspiring, whatever the reason may be. Something valuable, something good, you expect. And you say, oh yes, to this I say yes. I had many other possibilities tonight, but I say yes to this possibility. And come here, deciding is making this resolution. Resolution is opening myself and making myself walking and coming here because I want to be there. So the will is always a yes to a value. We will need that when we want to understand more addiction as a background. Let us come to addiction. First, formal descriptions. In DSM, it is perfectly described. This is the classical description. You may know that, and it's nothing new, but just to remember, addiction is defined as a drive to a substance or to an object. Object like gambling, substance like alcohol, heroin, etc. And this drive has a specific characteristic. The person cannot resist anymore. And this leads to increase of the quantity and the frequency and change of tolerance. One gets accustomed, and especially in alcohol, after a certain time, the quantity is no longer tolerable, and it needs only a 10th% or so of the quantity of alcohol to get drunk. After an increase of quantity over maybe some years, until it comes to that breakdown. Craving. People invest time, concentration, money to get the stuff because it is irresistible. Your life starts turning around the stuff and the addictive behavior. And if the addiction cannot be satisfied, the need cannot be satisfied, the drive goes into the vein, then we get symptoms of withdrawal. In alcohol, it's mainly the trembling, or people get nervous, or get depressive, or bad humor, mood, etc., aggressive, etc. In ICD-10, I will just drink a line or point to this phrase, with addiction, it goes together a progressive neglect of alternative pleasures or interests in favor for drinking. So this is, first it is a choice, and then it becomes an automatic behavior. We cannot stop to continue our work to continue normal work and find pleasure in that work, because the pleasure in drinking or in doing the addictive behavior, whatever it may be, is more attractive, is more and more replacing the normal values, the normal pleasures, the normal interests we had before. What means addiction? Addiction is a word which comes from the Latin and means speaking, dicere, ad dicere. Ad means towards, to, speak directly to. This means to agree immediately. Addiction is like sticking on the stuff. The stuff speaks directly to me and I react immediately with my agreement. I cannot resist. There is no distance between me and the stuff. The stuff is triggering my, let's say, response, my reaction. Therefore, the term addiction was chosen to describe this experience. It's quite a good term, although it's no longer in use in the scientific context. It is still correctly in use in public speaking about addictive behavior. In contrast to addiction, we know the word dedication, which comes from the Latin dedicere, which means dedicere means to speak from above. Free response. There is distance between me and the other. And then we have dialogue. In addiction, we are stuck. There is no dialogue. There is nothing in between. In dedication, there is a bit of distance, so that we can move freely. In German, the word is Sucht. And Sucht does not come from seeking, as one could think. It comes from seeking who's Dutch, or it seek means sick, the English sick. So Sucht, literally translated, means simply sickness. But what is sick? The will does not come to a free decision. It looks like this at the first. It is irresistible what I'm confronted with. I cannot say no. I'm speaking directly to it. I'm reacting directly. I'm addicted. So we experience a loss of control. Loss of control means, in other terms, the free will is not prevalent, is not around, is in cage, is in imprisoned. Loss of control, who is controlling normally? Isn't it me who drinks, who gambles, who takes drugs, and isn't it me? Who loses control over whom? We can say the ego, me. Do not follow me as a person. I do not, my decisions, my actions do not correspond anymore to what I feel deeply inside, to what I feel to be correct, to what I feel would be good, meaningful, direct towards something good. When I'm under the ban of the stuff, when I'm under the ban of my addiction, when addiction becomes dominant, then the me, loses contact, the connection with the inner person with the true self. Some people use that word. So that means that me as the person, as the essence, who I am really, is no longer present and active. It's the person is dethroned, has no power, has no influence, is not heard. And instead of the person, something like a foreign power is dominating me. And I'm following that foreign power. We are dependent no more from ourselves. We are dependent from something else, from some foreign elements, stuff, etc. I'm not congruent with myself. I'm not in touch with myself. I'm deviated from myself. And so I lose myself, I lose my essence, I lose my inner freedom, because person is defined as that what is free in the human being. That what is saying yes or no in the inner consent. This is the person which comes out, which appears in that phenomenological attitude towards oneself, to give freedom to myself, to just to listen what is it saying, not to prescribe to what is coming up. This giving space, this open attitude towards myself, helps me to be authentic. If I connect to what is resonating within me, then I'm really me. If I'm connecting to what other people say, or to what is in what is fashionable, or etc., this is not authentic behavior, this is copying behavior. Authentic behavior means to be really free, because I'm able to connect with something I do not make, with something I just receive, with something which is showing up within me, which is constantly present. But as a potential, it is present as a potential, it must be real by the ego, by me. So, sick, what is sick? We are still in that question. Dependence is a sickness, a psychological, respectively psychosomatic sickness, which has a specific characteristic. It is dominated by impersonal behavior. It has characteristics. But every addicted person, or people who work with addicted person, can say, I have an idea what it means, impersonal behavior. Instead of values, there are just triggers. There are values change into a stuff. They do not experience the value of a wine. An addicted person needs alcohol. May it be a cheap wine or an expensive wine, he doesn't even taste that wine. He's drinking it to calm down the need. It makes it a means, and doesn't experience the value, is not able to enjoy the quality, because it needs, the addicted person needs the stimulus. Effects are sought. The only goal is to have an effect, the alcohol effect, or the drug effect, or the gambling effect, and not the enjoyment. Enjoyment is free. One is concentrated on the inner world. The outer world becomes forgotten more and more, fades away. And the stuff is replaceable. It may be alcohol, or it may be wine or beer or whiskey or whatever. In sexual addiction, whoever is around fits for the pleasure, fits for the diminution of the need. It need not be you. There's no personal relationship. It is, everything is replaceable. It's just searched the effect on oneself and not the encounter. And the addicted person has no partners. So this is impersonal behavior. This changes one's life. It makes the life less existential, and it inhibits fulfillment in life, because there is no encounter, there is no dialogue, there is just feeding and calming the need within oneself. So I tried to describe a bit the connection between will and meaning. The will is the expression of the human freedom. When I can do what I want, then I'm really free. When I want to go home and I'm allowed to go home, then I can, then I feel free. And then when I want to stay longer at work and I can do that, then I'm free. When I'm inhibited to do it, or when I'm in prison, I cannot go wherever I want. So the restriction of free will, restriction of movement, is loss of freedom. The will is based in the four fundamental existential motivations. This is not the theme of tonight, but those who know it, symbolically represented by these pillars, which hold the will up and stem it up. And the will is directing towards the meaning. Meaning gives the orientation. Meaning is the direction I follow towards something valuable. And this valuable is not put by myself. It is found in the ambience. It's found in the world around us. And it is taken out of this wind of the questions of life, which is coming up every day. Every day brings me new questions of life and invitations, like the invitation of tonight or the invitation afterwards to go with a friend to some place, or to meet or to speak or to call somebody. Possibilities I have around, and find out the best possibility in this actual situation. This gives me meaning, because the will is there because it is directed towards a value, and if we look at the best value in the situation, then we get fulfillment, then we lead a meaningful life. The will can be attacked by needs, by deficits, by problems, by tensions, by psychodynamics, which attack the will. And if these attacks become strong and constant or last for a longer time, then addiction is developing. Let us ask a little bit ourselves. Addiction, of course, is a human inclination. It's not only the case that addicted people, dependent people, are sick. We all have and know more or less addictive behaviors. It starts with customs we have, and when the custom, like going for jogging every Wednesday evening, and if this custom is cannot be fulfilled, then we feel awkward, if something is wrong. It is not addiction, but it is a step before addiction. So we feel a certain thrive to it, towards it. We see a certain need, and if something unusual happens, then we are thrown off the track of our life. So we we also know that some things are very pleasurable, and we have possibly sometimes eaten more than we needed, or drank more. Who ate once in her life or in your life more than you needed? Are there some people around? What a question, yeah. Or maybe we drink, or something is very dangerous for me, chocolate. This is really... and so we know the experience that it is sometimes hard to resist. There is seduction, there is attraction, and it feels fine, at least at the beginning. When we ate too much, then we need a cognac afterwards to digest. So with one addictive tendency, we help to overcome the other addictive tendency. And the intention to speak about this is to make clear that we all are dealing with values and decisions, and it experience and feel how this is affecting on our lives. We enjoy it, but sometimes we have the feeling we need more enjoyment, we need a bit more than is healthy, than it would be enough because of the calories which are combined with it, and the time which is lost by that gambling or television, or and the calories with the sweets and internet and smoking and even jogging. Everything can produce an effect on us that makes us a bit addictive, more or less addictive. There is virtually nothing which cannot produce addiction. And when we experience such values and pleasures, then we experience it as it does good. This is this which is the beginning of addiction. But this is also a pleasure which we need to have in our life. Otherwise our life would be quite empty and thin and not vital enough. This but what are we searching when we eat a bit more, when we drink a bit more, when we look more television or listen to music than is good, that we get may have a bad moral conscience about it, and still we do it? What are we looking for? This is the big question which we must understand, otherwise we have no idea what is going along in addiction. This leads us to the chapter Development of Addiction. Formally, I do not speak much about this, just to mention it. Addiction is a combination, an interaction of three main territories, three main different elements. Its combination leads to addiction. There are the societal and cultural elements. Every culture has addiction and has a culture of addictive stuffs. In our culture, it's mainly alcohol, which is allowed. Other cultures have other stuffs, and cultures also produce needs which we deal with some addictive behavior. Produce lacks, produces, problems which foster addictive behavior. The substance itself, there are many different substances, about 12 different substances, categories of substances with own addictive power which make dependent. For instance, marijuana makes less dependent than alcohol. So there was a big movement in the 70s to have marijuana for free, like alcohol. And it's true that the addictive power is less than alcohol. But the effect on the brain is seemingly more dangerous than in alcohol, although the alcoholic effect on brain and nervous system is considerably high. And individual elements, physical elements, genetic, psychological elements, attitudes, ideas, values, etc., a person lives for. Let us come to a more psychological or processual understanding of addiction. What is the seed of addiction? We see it in the deficit in feeling the life itself, the quality of life. We may be guided perfectly by our rational decisions, but if we do not feel that what we do is good, is fulfilling, is pleasurable, is lively, then an emptiness remains. And when we are not really fulfilled by what we experience most time in our, let's say 80% of our time, when we do not experience this good, this interesting, stimulating, and if this emptiness, which may be unconscious at the beginning, if this emptiness is becoming stronger and stronger, then any stimulus which provokes a lively experience, any stimulus is experienced as a value, because values have the task to connect ourselves with life. And we make the same experience as if we listen to Beethoven or go for a walk. When we finally take a whiskey and a second one, because it's so good, it gives that feeling of life. I
code
feel
blue, Providence 5 Alpha, Code Blue, Providence 5 Alpha, Code Blue, Providence 5 Alpha.
Thank you. I feel life there, and this becomes irresistible the more I'm hungry for life, the more I'm lacking this experience of closeness, of warmth, of satisfaction, of enjoyment. The more I'm lacking this, the more I'm inclined to react stronger and stronger to an experience like a gambling session, or sex, or marijuana, or whatever gives me an immediate experience of this is something extraordinary, something special. This awakes my feelings of life. And then I get conditioned. The more I do it, the more I get trained. I learn that behavior. And it comes to a fixation. This is because this stuff produces quicker and more intensely the feeling of life than the normal things which I'm not able to reach because I'm too rational, because I'm too strictly educated, And so the normal values fade away in contrast to that stimulus of which makes me addicted. It is the easiest way, it is accessible, it is quick, and it is very effective. And if we make this experience on the background of a lack of life, of a lack of feeling of life, of feeling of quality of life, feeling of fulfillment in life, on this background, it becomes more and more irresistible to follow that stuff. And we say yes to the stuff. This means the will is there. The will says yes to a value. The role of the will is very important in the development of addiction, as we will see. So the basis of addiction is the experience of pure life by that stimulus. And it leads to a relief of problems. To a relief from all that what separates from life. When I have problems, conflicts, after two whiskies, they are not so bad anymore. Maybe three whiskies. So I show you here, we don't go into detail. When we go back, you see experience of pure life and relief from problems. And we deepen that a bit, just to give you an idea. The experience of pure life means there can be a physiological inclination. This is the direct substance effect on a neurochemical basis. Pure life means when deficits are compensated, like feelings of menor of inferiority. When I have a whiskey or two, then I don't feel inferior anymore. I'm much stronger than I was before. So I compensated the deficit. It gives me a feeling of better life. And it leads to an over-evaluation of that stuff, of that experience. The other side is addiction is developing on the two legs of feeling of pure life and reduction of problems, fading of problems. The relief of tension, like anxiety or depression or borderline personalities, they are so full of tension that they cannot resist to stuff which reduces the tension. So it comes to an escape of these tensions which separates from life, and we experience pseudo-solutions by the stuff. And together with that starts a learning of avoidance. And we train this new behavior with the consequence that it becomes more and more a desire to have the stuff, to find better life, to find more intensive life. It outsizes the values and leads to a fixation in the attraction. And we develop an avoidance of suffering, which leads to an alienation of life. And it becomes more and more difficult, the way back to normal life, and problems accumulate. And then we need even more the stuff. So it is a vicious circle which starts. You see, if you just remember this, the desire, the attraction of the desire increases because there is a lack of good relationship to experienced and felt life. And the suffering, it seems that we can avoid suffering by using that stuff, because for the moment it fades away the problems. But it makes the suffering belongs to life. If we do not confront the problems and do not face them, we suffer from an alienation of life. Just quickly, anthropological background. What makes stuff, what makes addictive stuff so attractive is more often the unusual or the exceptional. In sports or in the forbidden, especially in sexuality or in drugs for youngsters, forbidden drugs, the new, the different, which makes oneself more special, or the crazy. These are, we all need some experiences of breaking through the narrowness of everyday and to free ourselves. We sometimes need it to be very crazy and exuberant and lively. And if we do not have it so much because we are in a very regulated society and civilization, then the need for addictive behavior becomes stronger. This is a cultural influence. Craving is basic in addiction. Craving can be understood as a psychological drive for searching, for having more experience of life. Because the addictive is saying, when I do not have the stuff, the gambling or whatever, then that's no more life. It's like being half dead without the stuff. I need it to feel that I am alive. So craving is this, really this search for having more life and intensive life. The addiction grows by the elimination of obstacles. We eliminate obstacles. This is just preparing behavior, rationalization and negotiations. And it grows by each relapse, because any relapse is paving the way for the next. The will has an interesting role in the addiction. There's an increasing focusing of how to get the stuff, concentration on thinking. During the whole day, a bulimic person thinks from the morning, beginning in the morning, the whole day about what he or she will eat in the evening in this bulimic addictive behavior. There's the spell of the attraction. The will cannot turn away from this valuable, seemingly valuable, attraction of what one is addicted. And there is a splitting of the will. The will is at the same time very strong. The person is able to do even to use even criminal activities to get to that stuff, because he or she absolutely wants it, and then where there is a way, and they find a way. And at the same time, it is weak, because the will cannot connect with the person, and after the experience of the addiction, one is regretting, because one feels that one really didn't want it. But when we are before the addictive behavior, we absolutely want it. So this is the splitting between weak and strong will. This is important, that we are aware that addictive behavior does not happen against the will. No drop of alcohol becomes behind our mouth without our will. May you be addictive as much as you are. It is still your will that you take it. But your will cannot resist. But you say yes to this enormous attraction, which seems to be a value. Then you are trembling because of the symptoms of withdrawal. it is an absolute need, and you say yes to reduce that pain and tension. And we say, and the addictive, there has a will. He wants to drink, he wants to have the stuff. The addictive is not without willpower. This is a big misunderstanding. But the will is dominated by something alien in oneself. And this is the devilish of addiction. That it is born by the own will. It's the tragic side of addiction. To have an intensive will at the beginning, when we go to the addictive behavior, the will is absolutely intensive. And afterwards, nobody stands behind their own behavior, because me as a person did not agree. Afterwards, after the satisfaction of the addiction, we feel nausea about it, because we feel that we authentically didn't really want it. But before, we wanted it so absolutely that we cannot resist. We are disconcerted. The will tips over to its traditional trace after the satisfaction, and we are clear again, and we see, and we are connected with the inner person. Before, I wanted intensively. Afterwards, I didn't want it. And so the unity of the human being is split. We are torn apart in the addiction. A few words about the prevention of addiction. To live with inner consent is, let's say, the best prevention you can do. This respects the inner neediness. This respects and resonates with outer offerings, and this means also that when we have a problem, that we cannot simply do as if there is no problem. If we have a good understanding and a good access to the inner yes, to the inner resonance, to that inner authenticity, this is, generally speaking, a very good the central element, as we see, for preventing addiction. And this means to correspond to the needs of the reality, to correspond to the needs of the feelings and relationship, to needs to correspond to the needs of being oneself and encounter, and to that what becomes valuable to the meaningful in our life. All this is condensated in the term inner consent. Some words about therapy. I do not go into details. I know there are many psychotherapists in here, but not all are working in that field. So just mention, this is quite normal for a psychotherapist to look at the case history, the conditions, the purposes of this treatment, the effects and consequences of drinking, and how it was applied, the history and the biographical background. We made an investigation in existential therapy. We had 337 inpatients who were treated 8 weeks, and EA was one treatment possibility, with other treatments which were used in that clinic as well. And we found that the EA effect was that the general state of health improved in these German tests, CASI and EWL. The existential scale, the self-transcendence and responsibility improved very much. self-distance and freedom rule improved a bit. Not as much as responsibility and self-transcendence. Self-transcendence means that we can step over ourselves and dedicate, commit ourselves to something else, something which we are not, which are not ourselves. Self-esteem and being anchored in oneself was improved, and social resonance and potentialities improved. Compared to the results of other psychotherapies, was that other psychotherapies were better in symptom reduction at the end of the 8 weeks in the clinic, and EA was better in the psychological health. So EA works more on the structural level, and we do not care about symptoms so much. We care much more about, this is maybe very ridiculous in North America, this is for, in our view, this is too superficial. We must work on the basis, and it turned out a very interesting result. A half a year later, 60% of these patients gave a feedback of their change 6 months later. And it turned out that the EA people had more reduction of symptoms after a half a year later than the other groups, who had more reduction of symptoms at the beginning. So it is worth working on deeper structures, and people can make use of it by themselves and improve considerably and significantly by themselves afterwards. Therapy goals and relapse plan, this is quite normal for those who work with dependent people. It is important to have a relapse plan. We have to count with relapse. This belongs to addiction, and how to behave then. And it is also important to give the explanation that dependence, addiction, is a sickness. They must understand themselves. In AA, this is a good work. They make it really clear that in Alcoholic Anonymous, that addictive people are sick and cannot help themselves alone. They need help from outside. In AA, it's even the relationship to God, to a higher force. Facing the problem, we look after the own understanding of the development of the addiction, how did it develop and what were the reasons behind. And the work of acceptance of this being sick, which is sometimes not so easy. Self-assessment, what are capacities, what can they do by themselves. Self-acceptance. Addiction is a part of myself, it's not only a sickness, it belongs to me and I have to live with it for the moment. But I'm not only addiction, I'm more, I can deal with it. There is a healthy part within me which can be strengthened, and so we can come to a better dealing with it. A lot of work has to do with the clarification of the motivation, the will, and to work on the agreement on specific strategies. We work on alternative strategies. We do not start in reducing the symptoms or the behavior. It's a bit different in outpatient departments and in inpatient departments, of course. But we first try to build up a healthier structure of life. We train the enjoyment, because if they cannot enjoy better and more things which are around in daily life, in every life, then how can they resist to the attraction of the addictive stuff? Reduction of tensions, of course, in borderline personality, don't start with work on the addiction, start with the work on the personality structure. Values and goals, instead of looking to be free from, to apply a concept of freedom which is dedicating oneself, which is connecting oneself with the values. I'm free for something. I'm free to bind myself. And to be free from is making me lonely and making the person independent. And out of this independency, an arbitrary behavior may result. We look at if there is a pressure of suffering. If people do not suffer from their addictive behavior, it's quite difficult to work with them. This means sometimes we have to free emotionality, that they come to a feeling of their bad behavior, the consequences they produce by themselves. The quest of meaning. Why become free from addiction? What is the meaning? What is what for is that person living? Many persons who suffer from addiction have no meaning, have no value in mind, no perspective towards a value. And so this is a central element in our work, to look at the broader horizon in which the person stands. And behind each must, there is this unconscious will. What do you really want? When you are addictive, when you behave addictively, what is what you are striving for? And what is the greater value of your life? What are the values you lost and where you can reconnect again? Like children, family, partnership, new relationship, art, sports, good feeling of the body, etc. So this leads to a reorientation of the will. Why reframe the question of meaning? And we can also use the will strengthening method. I want to concentrate a bit more on this specific existential pathway. This is I think probably it is not known very much outside existential analysis, and it is has a specific effect. We look at the felt experience and constantly ask after the inner consent. This follows the method of personal existential analysis, which is abbreviated here. We connect to the own feelings and say, and ask the client to look at what he or she feels when they do the addictive behavior. This is possibly in the outpatient. We can do it only in the outpatient treatment. In the inpatient treatment, we cannot allow people to drink or to use more drugs or so. But when they gamble, when they drink, they should go home. And they are allowed to do it when it comes. They do it since a long time. If they do it 10 times more, it's not so important. But they can install their person, their freedom, and in applying this phenomenological attitude towards themselves. What do you feel when you drink? Watch at your feelings. And look at that. What becomes better when you drink? Observe it. Do it and observe. And open your mind a bit to the surroundings. And what becomes worse? So the focus is, do you experience, let's say, drinking as being good? Do you experience it? Because most people drink and do not watch their feelings, their experience. They think it's something else. say, detract their attention from what is going on in themselves. So it is not, let's say, the aim is not, let's say, judge it, let's say, think about it. The aim is just allow your concrete experience when you eat your chocolate. It may not be a clinical, necessarily a clinical addiction, it may also be an everyday little addiction. Allow yourself to feel and concentrate on what is really going on in yourself. And then the second step, to understand, this is the first, the connection of the addiction with the old feeling. Is it good? Do you experience it as such? Then the second step, do you understand that you drink? Do you have the feeling that you ultimately want to drink, or do you experience it that it happens to you? And then to come to a stand towards it and saying and asking the client, do you agree with your drinking? Ask yourself. The first step is, how do you experience it? And then ask yourself, do you feel that you agree? Do you consent? What would you have to do that you can come to a consent to your behavior? So, with one eye, the client is trained to look at the own felt experience, and with the other eye, to look at the inner consent towards it, if it is there or not. And then to practice it concretely, the third step. If we ask him or her if they agree to try it, to realize this training, this focusing on the ongoings in oneself. The result is that either they do not agree, or they agree. As long as they have the feeling that they agree and find it to be better than not drinking, we have no motivation. You can forget any therapy. You cannot treat a person against his or her will. And it is better to have it clear from the beginning than to have frustrations in therapies which lead the person to not do it again when time has come. And it saves money and time. And sometimes people have to drink or to be addicted for a longer time until they are mature to come to a treatment. And we are so radical in existential philosophy, in existential analysis. Every human being is free to die his own death. So if somebody is no longer willing to live and wants to kill himself or herself, protracted suicide, then we cannot stop a person to commit suicide. We can offer help, we can confront a person, but finally, we are free. We are free to kill ourselves. Camus says this is the beginning of philosophy. Because we are so free that we can kill ourselves. No animal can do that, but we can do it. And this makes us free. And this belongs to the human dignity. And we all behave in a way which is not the healthiest way. We work more than we should, or we jog more than it is healthy, and so we are committed to to ideas and sacrifice sometimes ourselves. It's not the healthiest. It's, we are not here to be healthy. We are here to follow our goals. And so if a person is not willing, then we are interested why the person is not willing to stop. And this, of course, this is a question, but not the treatment of addiction. This is maybe radical, but it is a clear position, and it gives back to the patient his own responsibility. I am not responsible for his health and for his life. She is responsible. I am there for helping. And I am, of course, interested in confronting the patient, the client, and why he, and I want to understand why he or she is behaving that way. But I am not the fulfiller of social needs and social desires, of bourgeois desires. I want to help the person to live his or her life as he or she experiments to be their life. So, if the person has no agreement, we talk about why he has no agreement and forget all treatment of addiction. If the person has if the person has agreement to continue, then we forget. If he or she has no agreement to the drinking behavior, then we have again two possibilities. Either the person is capable to come to a distance to oneself, to the behavior, or he's not able to come to a distance. When the patient, the client, is capable to slowly distance from his or her behavior, then we can support the self-distancing behavior, which leads from impotence to active dealing with the situation, and we can support it by techniques like interposition, experimental work, etc. These are details then. But what do we do if the patient says that I do not agree to my behavior, but I'm not capable to distance myself? The attraction is too strong again and again. I do it, although I feel that I cannot resist. Although I feel that it's not good and I feel that it does not correspond to me. Then we apply this concept of freedom again, which is central in existential philosophy, psychology. We say, well, the basis is you should not do more than you can do. If you are not able to resist, then do it. Allow yourself. Accept your weakness. This is self-acceptance. This is the very deep, fundamental acceptance of the addiction. Allow yourself to drink. And say, tell yourself that for the moment, I must live my addiction. I cannot change it. The motto is, don't try to do more than you can. If you really feel and see you cannot do it by yourself, do it. And experience it and concentrate on what you experience. And when you again experience that you cannot resist, then you tell yourself, well, I have done whatever I could, I cannot do more, and with my really open moral conscience, I must face this reality. This is practicable in small addictions and in many more addictions. Alcohol can be done quite well with this. There are new treatments in Europe, in the experimental phases, in university clinics, where they get alcohol in the clinic, for instance, to treat. It is better and cheaper than Valium, for instance. There is a revolution coming up. We are no longer so strict in the treatment of alcoholism than we were the last decades. And the goal is not no more the absolute refrain from alcohol. The goal is to live with alcohol, even for the addicted people. 20 years ago it was impossible, it was an absolute no-go. The treatment goal in addiction was to have total freedom of, total refrain from alcohol. No longer. There's a big revolution going on, also in other addiction work, not only in alcohol. So, this leads to acceptance of this fatal part in the sickness. And it leads to an acceptance and remaining a person with my addiction. And the effect is most often that after a while they get really fed up by their addiction. And they become stronger, and they feel more nausea, and this helps them, with this psychodynamic power which comes up, helps them to refrain, to step back, to get out, to step out of this addictive behavior. There's another method we apply, just to say in a few words, I will not explain it in the whole length. We can even apply free decided use of the addictive stuff before we are forced to use it. So this maintains the feeling of freedom when people feel that in a while, maybe in a couple of hours, they will come to that point where they cannot resist anymore, that they start doing it before they have to do it. Because they know they have to live with this addiction, but now they do it deliberately to maintain their feeling, their experience of I am a person, and as a person I am free, and I know I have to deal with this effect, with this fact, and I do it get to feel the poignant power of addiction, and I do it by myself, freely. Well, some more work has to be done to work on the ego losses. There are deficits in these fundamental dimensions of existence, which is specific work in existentialism, which leads too far now, just to give an idea that of course there is needed much more work and deeper work. This existential pathway I told was just a form of expanding the dealing capacity with addiction. But then we have to go to the roots, because addiction is always a sign of a deeper lack, loss, problem, conflict, or an other primary disorder. So these must be treated then. Addiction in itself is no more understood as a disorder in itself. It is a symptom of another disorder, another disturbance. And then biographical work, of course. Let's come to the conclusion. Addiction is a combination of the wish for a full life, the wish of intensive life, of good life. And this is so important. It is something valuable even in the addicted person, that they want to have more life and don't find a better way, of course. And this wish for a fuller life, is drawing with this power of the vital need of psychodynamics, which is fighting for more life, for better life. And it comes, of course, to a fixation, because there are deficits, there is depression behind, there is anxiety behind, there is personality disorder behind. And the more disorders are behind, the stronger becomes the addiction. The addiction is combined with phobias to 23%, or with anxiety 24%, affective psychosis 30%. You know, half of the schizophrenic patients are addictive, mostly smoking. And the antisocial personality disorders has the highest degree of, and antisocial and borderline personalities have up to 90% of them are addicted. So the stronger the disorder is, the stronger becomes the addiction, because they are away from life, they are separated from what is good to live for. So the impulse, the psychodynamic impulse, this vital power, which is so helpful and is so important in our life, combines with this wish to have more life. And they feel correctly what they need, but they have begun a way which is not really resolving their problems. So to conclude, we can say getting drunk alcohol or drugs are very common in many religions. So, and in ancient religions, this the Pythia in Delphi, for instance, she was constantly under drugs and gave the oracles. And so getting drunk is something which is sometimes very, almost divine, very, very fine and helpful. And it relieves us from the narrowness of this earth and our problems and our daily life and the boredom, etc. So, Satyr, Dionysos, they were gods in ancient Rome. They are not gods in North America. Maybe there could be a cultural shift. But addiction clearly is a step too far. Addiction is like falling into the hell, from this heaven, from this that can be a heaven. If it happens sometimes when we celebrate something, that we drank a bit too much, that we cannot drive anymore. If not every person likes it, but some do, and if we do, it's not so bad to have this experience sometimes, maybe every second year or so. I don't know if you would agree with that, or every 5 years. Okay, but devilish, it is diabolic, the addiction, because it splits our unity, and the will is shifting from fighting for the stuff and rejecting the own behavior. Thank you for your attention.
So we have a few minutes for questions, and when you ask your question, I'll repeat it. If I don't do it justice, please correct me on that. But we just want to capture this for the film. So does anyone have any questions for Alfred? Yes, sir.
I have one. It seems like there's two different kinds of addictions. There's ones with people that are at the bottom of the socioeconomic scale, people from poor neighborhoods are drawn to alcohol and heroin and stuff like that because they're born in a desperate situation, born into a deficit. And the other addiction, at the opposite end of the scale, there's 800 people with 80% of the money in the world, and their addiction is to power and to money. So by focusing on the symptom, which is the people that are addicted to alcohol and these things, it seems like we're almost trying to put band-aids on these razor blade cuts while there's a bullet wound over here that's causing the entire problem altogether. And I'm wondering what's the answer to curing that addiction, the addiction to power that is creating the situation that creates the addictions on the other end of the spectrum.
I could try to rephrase that, but I think you're loud enough for the mic to catch it right here. So I'm going to let Alfred go ahead and speak to this, the addiction of power to which you speak.
Yeah, I have no answer to your question, but I can say nevertheless something. And the first is, of course, we can get addicted, as I said before, to everything, also to power. So the stuff then is to be able to dictate people, their will, and to experience narcissistic gains, and this can make people addictive, especially when you have inclination towards narcissism, for instance, or sadistic tendencies, etc. So power is also a means where or an object to which we can become addictive. The other day I just read that there was a new investigation in Europe that showed that the socioeconomic influence on addiction is quite enormous, not only on the lower level, that people who are from low or difficult social situations and socioeconomic situations, they have a stronger tendency toward addiction, but also academic and old people. The old people and academic people are higher in addiction than the lower socioeconomic people. When we count the level of addiction was or abuse, it was not addiction, it was abuse, alcohol abuse was very low, so maybe maybe it was too low. This was the critique on this investigation, but it was interesting, something which was not so well known or not in the consciousness, that academic people drink more in the average than poor socioeconomic people. And older people drink more than young people. The young people have a bad custom nowadays. When they drink extremely. But in between, most of them don't drink at all. So the older people grow, the more they drink, with the peak in 74 years of age. Then it goes down. So this is also something we have to consider more, and it is an expression of culture. Yeah. So as so much about the socio-economic background on drinking this is alcohol especially, not marijuana, and the old people, it's alcohol. And, yeah. But you asked something like, how can we explain that there are two forms of addiction? I would say it's the same form of addiction. Power addiction, alcohol addiction, drug addiction, it's always the same. The grammar behind addiction is what I tried to explain here. And there is a personal need. And some people feel more life when they have lots of money and they are very rich, and since they don't feel enough life, they buy a yacht, a boat, and a plane, and they buy half of the world, and they do not feel more life, but they feel a bit more life when they can make invitations and see that people admire them, and are addicted to this admiration by their spending money and showing their richness. or power. So, but the background is the same. They are very poor in life. Yeah. Maybe this does answer your question. I don't know.
I don't know if it's an answerable question. So.
Yeah. So me either. I doubt if it's answerable.
All right. So we have a question here, and then we'll go over here. So yes.
Concurrent disorders have increased over the years, and I'm wondering existentially how would you approach that? Do you attack the non-addictive side of the diagnosis, or do you attack the addiction side of the diagnosis first because of the concurrent stuff, and they're feeding off of each other?
So with the increase of concurrent disorders, which do you focus on first, the addiction or the other?
But I didn't understand the first phrase.
Oh, concurrent disorder. So having both an addiction as well as the other disorder that may... You were talking about the primary.
It depends on the case. When the addiction is strong, then we try to reduce a bit the addiction. Because as long as they are too addicted, we cannot treat the underlying disorder in many cases. But for instance, in borderline personality disorders, our experience is that if you start to work on the addiction, you have no ground. Or in bulimia, for instance, we normally do not work about bulimia. Let them behave their bulimic behavior and look at where do they feel alone, lonely, for instance. Where do they have problems? What they want to numb, to not to have to feel it, or to come to a compensation of the loss which is combined with their problem, compensation by their addictive behavior. And when we start there, and when they start to care for a good life and have and develop more and more good life, then the time has come to treat the bulimia. And sometimes we don't even have to talk about the bulimia because it stops by itself. So it depends on the cases. We must have, the main goal is to have treatable the person. And when they are too alcoholic and constantly under alcohol, we cannot work on the underlying problems. But sometimes, if we give that person an antidepressant, they can stop the alcohol easier because they do not suffer anymore from a deeper depression.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a question over here.
Sure, thank you. I'm Dave. I'm just a guy, not a physician, so I just wanted to qualify. Forgive me if my question is ignorant. By the way, thank you for sharing your knowledge with us this evening. I appreciate it. My question is, we spoke of the power of the will when it's connected to the ego as we travel down this path towards this object, whatever it may be, gambling or alcohol or whatnot. When one starts distancing themselves from that and works their way back and establishes this inner consent, if you will, and works our way back. Is there a chemical release or a stimulus as we work our way back against the addiction towards freedom, for example? Does that happen along the line of somewhere along the continuum? Or is there a chemical release?
There are good chemical reliefs from craving, for instance. And we can work sometimes with antipsychotic or neuroleptic medications or minor tranquilizers. But a part of, and this is sometimes a very important part of treatment, but a part of this, it is so important to work on the own attitude, on your own will, and to have an understanding of the role of the will. Because if it is an addiction, there is no chemical stuff can come to a total relief or healing from the addiction. It needs a different way of life, a different style of life, different attitudes, and to work through bad experiences and lacks of life and losses, etc. And then the change can happen. But chemical stuff, like anti-craving drugs, can really help and contribute a great deal in the improvement of the treatment. Thank you.
We have time for one last question here.
Okay. I'm just wondering, just from my own observation, it seems in meeting other addicts, it seems like a lot of people who become addicted have a pretty high level of intelligence. There's a lot of really smart people in the treatment centers. And I wonder if you've noticed that and if there's any basis for that, and whether you think it's more because highly intelligent people are more susceptible to like mental illnesses, or more just on an existential level, that they're more likely to feel that sense of not enough meaning or disconnection from the world.
Yeah, this is an observation which I appreciate to hear, which I didn't make, that the IQ is higher in addictive people than in the normal population. In my experience, it was more or less the same. But it may happen, and my primary understanding for this would be that it is possibly more difficult to live a life with a higher intelligence, because you are not so easily satisfied by the answers you get about what is important in one's life. And you are questioning more. And if a person is not lucky to have had a good background in relationships, in the family, and in actual relationship, and very intelligent people have it more difficult sometimes to have good actual relationship, because they are more critical and maybe more demanding, and so that they feel more separated from life. And when they lead a life, and our school system is focusing on developing their intellectual capacity and not so much the emotional capacity, then when they lead their life in a more rational way, then they are far away from a fulfilling existence than people who are a bit more simple-minded and have the grace to be more closer to life.
Thank you. Is it a quick question?
Very brief.
Okay. Very quick.
One very brief question.
I need to understand more clearly how you define acceptance. Self-acceptance in existential terms in one sentence.
This is the hardest question. It would be easy to give you a talk about acceptance, but just in one sentence. Acceptance means let it be as it is. Let it be as it is. To let be. Letting is a very important part of the will. A real will is capable to let be. Otherwise, it's a cramp. Thank you.
Given all the distinctions, Alfred, given all the distinctions you made between alcohol and marijuana, I think that I should be giving you something other than BC wine. Because BC does produce some very good marijuana. But we're going to give you some wine this evening, so thank you very much.
Considering my age, you prefer the wine.
Maybe so. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And don't forget, there are some flyers down here that talk about some upcoming trainings.
Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, yeah.
Hi, Alfred. I met you last time you were here. I just want to say thank you so much. You were fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.